You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. We all have that one great aunt who's really into tracing the family's heritage. At least I do. And as much as I don't really care about my third cousin once removed from Denmark, I can appreciate what she's doing. There's something intriguing about uncovering our own origin stories. This week, we have two stories about people tracing their ancestry and learning new things about themselves and their communities in the process. Our first story takes us to the shores of Yarra Bay, where we'll hear about the origins of one of the first social enterprises established in Australia.
Everyone who's either lived in Sydney or spent some time here would have been to the Sydney Fish Markets, or at least heard about it. A bit of an institution to go there with your family, have a feed, take in the harbour. And it wasn't until I was older that I found out the connection that my community in La Perouse actually has to that place. I was told that it was originally started when fishermen from our community in the late 1800s were fishing in Botany Bay and the surrounding areas. And after fulfilling their culture responsibilities by giving fish to their family, both immediate and extended, they would then go and sell this fish with the help of some prominent families in the colony, the Hills and the Wentworths, and achieve an economic return.
That was Ash Walker. He's a Darawal Durga man from the La Perouse Aboriginal community. He's also a board member of the Gujaga Foundation, and I'm the general manager. And I'm Sally Walker. I'm also a Darawal person from the La Perouse Aboriginal community.
It made me feel two things. Firstly, I felt a bit stupid that I hadn't heard of earlier, but two, was also really proud of my ancestors who really proved that they could adapt quite well to the changing environment around them, which was being increasingly affected by colonial influence.
Ray Ingray is a Dungutty Darawal man from the La Perouse Aboriginal community, and he's the chairperson of the Gujaga Foundation.
We're currently on at a place that we call Gurawal or La Perouse. And this is the site where our Aboriginal community were placed in 1883 by the New South Wales Aboriginal Protection Board. And not too far from here, we've got, across from the bay, you've got a place that we call Kundal or Kurnell. And that's where 250 years ago, Lieutenant James Cook and the crew of the Endeavour landed, and our people at that time were, and our families that belonged to La Perouse, were in and around coastal Sydney and Botany Bay.
In 1883, the La Perouse community was formed by George Thornton, a former mayor of Sydney. Thornton used the drowning of an Aboriginal boy as an excuse to establish the New South Wales Aborigines Protections Board. They rounded up every Aboriginal person living in places like the Sydney Boat Shed, Elizabeth Bay, Rose Bay, and numerous camps around Botany Bay. They were forcibly removed to the northern head of Botany Bay, the La Perouse Mission. My grandmother's great-grandparents were living on the northern head with four other families at that time. Today, the La Perouse Aboriginal community is the only discrete Aboriginal community in the Greater Sydney area. That means you can physically see the community. We're not just scattered in the suburb, and the families belonging to our community have ancient roots back to this cultural area.
Indigenous people here were quick to engage in the economy of the colony. People like Ma Root were running fishing tours. He had a fishing hut down at Botany, didn't he? Yep. And run tours out of their lease fishing boats, I believe, too. Yep. And in addition, there are other members of our community who used to run fishing and hunting tours to the south, and the way they used to drum up business was to spread rumours of cannibals to the south. This was, of course, made up. Same cultural group runs from Sydney Harbour down to Illawarra and then again down to the Shoalhaven. That's just an example of how our people quickly adapted, made up some aggressive marketing campaigns and engaged quite effectively.
Ray says that the Laperouse community had one of the first social enterprises in the colony.
So how they turned it into a fishing enterprise was that different species of fish come in at different seasons. So at the moment now, this season is a murra season or mullet season. And so what they would do is they will catch a haul. And so they were hauling in fish, providing half of their catch to the community to meet that responsibility, and then on-selling it to the Hill and Wentworth families, who would then on-sell it to what we now know as the Sydney Fish Markets. And so that was actually generating an income. They were feeding the community but also getting an income as well. So we're on the shores of Yarra Bay, and on the other side there you've got fresh water stream that come out, and it was actually the place where Arthur Phillip, leading the first fleet, got their fresh water from when they landed here in Gamay or Botany Bay. And it's also the site where our community undertakes cultural fishing in the mullet seasons to provide food source to our community. So you would see in the waters, it's a cold time of year, so it's when the temperature drops, but in the actual water itself, you start to see a lot more schools of fish activity. So, and at that time, it's the murra murra that comes in, or the big schools of mullet. And particularly when they're calm days, you'll start to see what we refer to as the water starts to boil. So it looks like that the water's boiling water, but it's actually just a big school of fish. And sometimes you'll see them swimming nice, but you'll see big shadows and big dark patches coming through, and depending on the colour and depending on the size of the shadow in the water, the old fellas can determine just how much fish and where they come from. So if it's a small school, they'll just let it go so it goes back out to sea and get bigger. If it's a big school, they'll try and cast it as long as they've got a big enough net. You'll have a person on the headland which they would look out for to give the heads up that there's a school of fish coming in, and they would drop the net and they would row, someone in a rowboat would row it around the school of fish. So as the fish come in, they'll row it around, and as it got back to the beach, you would have the men would then pull the nets in, and as they're pulling the nets up into the beach, they're dragging obviously the fish up, and they're able then to move the fish. But mostly the senior man would be sitting here, and he would either direct or tell them like if it's a go or not to get fish, because sometimes it might be too small and they'd prefer to go out, but they'll also be able to determine if it was economically benefit to go and haul in that fish, and they're able to calculate how many, the size, by just looking at the size of the school underwater, on how many boxes they'll fill up, and then they'll be able to calculate how much they will get per box at the market, and they'll be able to determine if it's worth it or not to actually drop the net and do the work. And so they would look at it from an economic point of view, but they'll also look at it from a cultural point of view, and they would determine it was more culturally important to let a school of fish to go back out to sea to get bigger, and then next season that will be a bigger school that they'll be able to at least get the majority of and haul in, but by that stage they would have bred a lot more.
The process of netting a haul is the same today in La Perouse as it was in the 1800s, when the social enterprise was thriving for our old people. But then the Protection Board began an investigation into why the community was rejecting rations.
So our understanding was that they made the move to shut down because the Protection Board couldn't understand why LARPers kept refusing rations. To strip their independence away, you've got to make them dependent on something, and LARPers didn't need the rations. fishing was obviously a food source, you know. So take away the monetary, the economic side of things. It was a way that we were able to feed ourselves. But that's a lot of cultural practices that were dismantled were the same way.
Yeah, you can look at it. It kind of happened pretty steadily as a way to dismantle our cultural practices. And to be honest, the structure of our society. First, they restricted our movement. We couldn't go around our cultural area anymore. We had to stay on La Perouse Aboriginal Reserve. Then they started to take away our means to feed ourselves independently, stopped us from speaking language, stopped us from conducting our traditional ceremonies. It was to the point where some people in our community were threatened with their kids being taken away if they were caught speaking their native language of Dharawal. So it's pretty heavy government intervention. It was hand in hand with government assimilation policies. They were doing their best to make us not be Aboriginal anymore. I think it's a large reason we have so many problems today as Aboriginal people. We went from being a society or a community which was completely self-reliant to one which was forced onto welfare dependence by the government, and it continued. So I would say that probably my father's and maybe my grandfather's generation were the first ones who kind of had an opportunity to engage in the economy. And you can see that with lack of intergenerational wealth in Aboriginal communities across the country. Compare it with non-Aboriginal families who are considered well off. That wealth is commonly built up over generations, and we had that opportunity taken away from us.
Now our community faces different challenges.
If you just look at the Bay over the last 70 years, it's been overdeveloped. Our men in particular were known to work over, say, in the industrial parts of Alexandria. They would walk from La Perouse over to that way, but they would actually carry their gararas or their fishing spears and leave them in the bush, and then when they would come home, they would come through and spearfish for dinner. That was restricted when, obviously, the airport and then the port was developed. And as they got bigger and bigger, country changed, and we're really now only restricted. We're coastal people, so we live off what comes out of the coast. So a lot of seafood is our diet, and we love it. But we're very limited on what we can, apart from the overfishing. The pollution in this bay is unbelievable. But we still go out and dive. So we know when the lobster season's on, or yanga we call it, and we'll go out and catch them. We know when the mullet's on, and we know all that. And so we still use this bay as a food source. And over time, that's impacted us from a spiritual and cultural point of view. And our community's current position, you know, we're opposed to any further development of Botany Bay. So here, even though it's called, we call it Gamay, our old people used to call it Kamay, it's just language evolves over time. The ocean we call Gatu, and our old people refer, and some of us still refer to ourselves as Garangu, which just means people belonging to salt water, or the ocean. In English, Aboriginal people will refer to themselves as per the environment they belong to, so saltwater people, freshwater people, mountains people. We saltwater people, but in our language we refer to ourselves as Garangu, which is Gatu is the ocean.
That story was produced by Eddie Diamond. Sarah Mashman was the supervising producer. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. All the Best is about training emerging Australian storytellers in the art of audio. If you'd like to be a part of the show, you can start by pitching to us at allthebestradio.com. We'll pair you with one of our supervising producers to help make your story. Sarath thought he was the first lawyer in his family. Turns out, he was wrong.
During one of those long, stretched-out COVID days, I found myself reflecting with pride on some framed graduation photos that my mum decided to put up of me at law school. These are photos that I'd never actually seen. Me, the first lawyer that ever existed in our family. It kind of meant a lot to me. Not because I felt like being a lawyer was somehow unique or particularly special, but it was because no one in my family had ever done it. And also, because my mum and dad didn't actually want me to become a lawyer. You see, they wanted me to become a doctor or an accountant, and by being a lawyer, I was actually being a rebel. A bit weird saying it out loud. It also reminded me of all the hard things I had to do just to make it happen. Moving out of home, buying a mattress, and even budgeting for ramen noodles instead of my mum's cooking. So at that moment, I was waiting for the kettle to boil to make a cup of tea for my dad, out of habit, but whenever I made one for myself, and asked dad if he wanted one. And he obliged on this occasion too.
My full name is Ravi Chandramurthy, and I've been living in this country for the last 30 years or so. I was born in India. Originally, I'm an engineer, but then when I came to Australia, did my PhD here, and then become a qualified academic in the university sector. My mother actually truly inspired me to believe in education is the only single source of development. And I also continue to believe that even today. As someone who lost my father when I was 4 years old, but with no economic support, no other kind of a support, the only way that I could actually bring myself up is through education.
But he's into other stuff too. He's really into tennis, the movies of Amitabh Bachchan, a famous Indian actor, Ray Martin, incredibly spicy chilies that will make you cry, and literally everything Agatha Christie. So for me, my parents had always wanted me to become an accountant or a doctor because it was something they considered to be safe, something they'd seen other people in our Indian community become. So when I told them I wanted to become a lawyer, they actually tried to stop me. And this is also because in India, being a lawyer was traditionally not considered a great thing, given the rule of law in India was not that effective when my parents were there. Me becoming a lawyer was actually an act of rebellion. So I'm staring up this photo and I see in my dad what I think is an impassive look. And in that moment, I wanted him to acknowledge it, all the hard work that I'd done. So I thought I'd ask him a question to maybe lead him in that direction. Dad, am I the first lawyer that ever existed in our family?
You are the first technically qualified lawyer, for sure. My grandfather and my great-grandfathers and generations before him were actually karanams of a few villages.
A karanam, as I found out, is a hereditary role of a person who acted as a mediator with the government on behalf of members of a village. And the village, which was in Andhra Pradesh, or South India, so essentially, my family on my dad's side have all historically been lawyers. A karanam was also part of a board of five or more members in a small village who dispensed justice for common civil and criminal cases. Things like land disputes, petty crime, water access.
Many of those small disputes like somebody has stolen somebody's chicken.
Chickens, Dad, that's your example.
Yeah, it's very simple, yeah.
So my great-grandfather apparently adjudicated on disputes about chickens. Surely not just chickens.
There are some complicated issues whenever there is a kind of a land dispute still be there. Where are the boundaries? Who should actually get the water first while they're actually capturing water into their crops?
Who was the last karanam in the family?
My father's brother's son was the last karanam. He was only as a karanam for a very short period of time. Subsequent for about 6 months, I was told.
Turns out my uncle was only a karanam for 6 months because the Indian government abolished the role altogether. So my relatives were judges of sorts, and I wanted to know if any of them were kind of famous.
My grandfather was actually well known, and he was viewed as a very intelligent man, much more intelligent than my father and my father's brother. So in fact, he used to say that his children were not good enough.
Do you think I'm good enough?
You are.
Okay, now I'm trying to picture who this great-great-grandfather was. You know, I'm trying to think of what he looked like, you know, what he would have wore. I'm imagining a regal slash tall man by those standards, educated, principled, probably, you know, probably wearing a suit and a tie, a man who was articulate and clever, someone who was Gandhi-esque.
No, there are no suits there, definitely. He never wore any suits. Even my father never wore any suit in his entire life. So there's no...
What do you think he wore?
He wore a pancha, you know, Andhra pancha.
What is that? Describe it.
Where you actually tie it down like this.
Dad, this is not a visual medium,
dude. It's not like a
lungi,
it's a white...
It's like a robe?
It's a white robe.
He would have worn a white robe.
White robe.
A shirt?
And a shirt.
So he would have worn a white robe and a shirt. No suit and tie.
No, definitely no tie. My great-grandfather never wore anything like that. He used to ride horse. That's his mode of transportation whenever he goes to different villages for inspection and for land disputes and things
like that. And for fun, I'm sure, for fun.
And of course, for fun also, he must have.
So, I'm trying to picture how cool he could possibly be. I'm picturing him meandering.
He's a very tall man. My grandmother used to tell me that he was very tall, taller than my father, taller than his two sons. That's what she always used to tell.
So, we got shorter as a family.
I'm the only one short in my family, so my other two brothers are relatively tall.
Okay, fine. I'm trying to picture my great-great-grandfather, someone who, you know, who would meander through the village, you know, all cool with the judge's self-esteem.
Yes.
Possibly wearing one of those judge's hats or wigs that the British gave him. You know, an Indiana Jones, if you will. Someone who was cool, carrying the full-size, you know, scale of justice in his backpack. Someone who had a quick wit, who could, you know, talk to all of the locals and be like, hey, how are you going? You know, flanked with interns probably. He had his, you know, assistants. And he's probably really good at cricket. I assume he was good at cricket. Probably a batsman.
Not cricket, but I was told that he was very good at ball badminton.
What does that even mean, Dad?
It's like a shuttle badminton, but you play with a smaller tennis ball. Exactly play like shuttle, but it's played with a small, lighter tennis ball.
How about our great-grandfather?
My grandfather was a very good player. He was good at this badminton. He used to go to tournaments to other villages and play and then, you know, win cups and things like that.
I discovered that shuttle badminton was in fact a game developed in British India, originating from the game battledore and shuttlecock. It's a racket sport played using rackets to hit a shuttlecock across a net, and it's an Olympic sport.
Mahatma Gandhi, was he around?
Yes, he was. He didn't come to our village at the time, but he was actually about 20 kilometers away from our village. He actually conducted a meeting and...
Everyone has a Gandhi story, Dad. Everyone from that era has a Gandhi story.
We went and watched him. That's it. Nothing much.
They didn't hang out with him. They weren't friends.
No, they weren't friends.
So you're saying to me with absolute confidence, we weren't friends with Gandhi.
No, unfortunately, no.
Sometimes you ask questions about your past and you don't quite know where it's going to end up.
How do you think he felt about caste?
Those days, caste is given. There's kind of an acceptance that, okay, you're born in this particular caste, so you are expected to perform like this. You're expected to do these kind of things.
My dad grew up in an impoverished Brahmin family, which was meant to be the educated class and historically very wealthy.
He was part of the system, really.
Yes, part of the system. There used to be scheduled caste kind of people who used to live far away from the village because they are not allowed to live in the village.
Why?
Because they are called as untouchable at the time. Yeah, that was unfortunate. But every village those days, almost every village has got a separate colony where these people used to live.
That's so unfair, right?
It is so unfair.
So my great-great-grandfather wasn't some noble champion.
No, he wasn't, but he was in a relative terms, he was very generous because he allowed them to enter into the premises of our home, these untouchable people. So he allows them to come onto his own ground and then sit outside and eat food. Whereas in a lot of other families in the village won't even allow them to step into their premises because they should not be in the eyesight of some people.
So maybe my great-great-grandfather was interesting, witty, but not really a revolutionary or the type that I'd imagined. That didn't stop me from wondering about the village of my ancestors, which was known as Moparo in Andhra Pradesh, India, and what it was like during those times.
I'm picturing this little, you know, industrial hub of a city, you know, with slums everywhere, children singing old ragas, and, you know, the sound of the sitar in the background, people dancing Bharatanatyam, the Indian dancing, beggars roaming the streets and asking for change, the sound of snake charmers, you know, playing their instrument, whatever that thing is, you know, mystics wearing orange clothes, you know, thick beards.
No, it wasn't like that. It wasn't that so-called glamorous or something silly. But the life was actually much better in the sense from some of the comparisons you actually made. There were no snake charmers on the street. There were no slums on the streets because villages at the time were relatively less populated. They were cleaner than today. My grandmother, we used to go to the same village where my great-grandfather stayed there. So there used to be a huge pond. That is the source of drinking water for the entire village. It's like a huge pond and most of the houses will be around the pond. That's the village. And in a farther distance, in one corner, there used to be a temple. In another corner, there used to be a school. And in another corner, there used to be a common area, huge tree. And underneath, it's all nice space for people to sit and conduct meetings. So my grandmother used to say every night, my grandfather, after finishing at dinner at 6:30, 7 o'clock, they will go and walk out to that particular Marri Chettu, they say.
Which means tree in Telugu, which is the Indian dialect that my family speaks.
About 20, 30, 40 people sit. Depending upon the popularity of the dispute, more people would go just as observers. Or if there is not a major issue like a chicken, then only a handful of people sit there and the judgment is passed.
So people would know when some juicy would be happening.
Yes.
Okay, how about this? I'm imagining in this village that we're from, you know, little houses, tree fronds, no electricity. But, you know, there would have been meandering, roving leopards and tigers walking through the village every now and then at nighttime. Lush green plantations, the scent of cardamom, curry leaves and incense wafting through the village homes made out of huts. Mango trees everywhere, abundant and juicy, and Gandhi walking around.
No, that is again is not completely factual. The roads are not properly paved. Therefore, if there is a rainy season, it's very muddy, and then, you know, you can't really walk without getting your feet completely dirty. There's no forest nearby. There's no dangerous wild animals coming anywhere nearby, only other than a few stray dogs barking on the street. You don't really find anything exciting than that.
No tigers?
No tigers, nothing.
No leopards?
Not definitely no leopards at all.
How about the juicy mangoes, Dad? Were there many juicy mangoes?
Yes, definitely. Juicy fruits were very common because a lot of homes would have these kind of trees. I remember very fondly in our own grandmother's home, there used to be a mango tree.
So this whole time, I've been living in absolute ignorance of my father's side of the family and our own history, or even ever thought about my great-great-grandfather, what he was like or what life would have been like. Even though I've always held this imaginary and romanticized image of what life for my family and my ancestors was probably like, entirely based on TV, books, and an unhealthy obsession with mangoes.
Let's be real here, Dad. You've been my dad for quite some time, and we're only talking about this fairly recently. Why?
Because for some reason, I don't know why, but we haven't really discussed about our past. I don't know. Don't really think much about the past, I think, unless there is a reason, unless there is a motivation to think about the past, I guess. My past is my childhood, which is not pleasant.
Though I was the first lawyer in my family, I was not the first in my family tree. It was hereditary for an incredibly long time. We were more involved with the law than we weren't. And it's kind of sad that I never realized, and I never asked my dad where my dad's side of the family came from. I never asked because I just assumed. And my dad never told me because, well, his history was painful. But it took a global pandemic for me to stand next to my father and just ask a really simple question about where he came from and why we never talk about a subject matter that was so close to us. And maybe in these moments when we're trapped with our family or the people that we care about or don't, it's not a bad time to ask some of those unasked questions. Because if you do, you might just discover that you were meant to be a chicken lawyer. Trust me, it runs in the family.
That story was produced by Sarath Chandra. The supervising producer was Allison Chan. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Ryan Pemberton. Jordan Fennell is our Victorian State Coordinator. The All the Best Community Coordinators are Chloe Gillespie and Danny Stewart. Our SYN Community Coordinator is Lee Robinson. Matilda Fay and Angela Moran are our social media producers, and I'm your host, Maddie McQueen. Shining Bird composed our theme music and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. We're heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and we're made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. You can find more episodes by searching for All the Best wherever you get your podcasts.